Sexual assaults on college campuses are sadly all too common. The latest federal campus safety data shows nearly 100 institutions had at least 10 reports of rape on their main campuses in the year 2014. What's less known, though, are these cases at the high school level. The American Association of University Women surveyed nearly 2,000 students in 7th through 12th grade. Nearly half had experienced some form of sexual harassment during a single school year. Title IX coordinators are supposed to be on hand to review allegations at both colleges and high schools. But a recent investigation by Slate magazine reveals that's not happening the way it should at many schools. Freelance journalist Nora Kaplan-Bricker worked on that story, and she joins me now by Skype. Good morning, Nora.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And also with us is Fatima Gross-Graves. Fatima. She's the Senior Vice President for Program at National Women's Law Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Fatima, explain to me why Title IX comes into play when we're talking about sexual assault. Most people know Title IX because it required that athletic programs for both genders receive the same amount of funding and attention. Why does it also refer to sexual assault allegations?
You know, Title IX bans sex discrimination in nearly every education program. And what that means in the context of sexual harassment is that everyone must be able to participate in school fully. And if you are harassed or experience violence because of your sex, it's nearly impossible to do so.
And Nora, what does the law require that high schools particularly do?
Well, the law requires that high schools have a designated Title IX coordinator, which is a person who has been trained to deal with victims, to sort of mediate with them through the investigation process, to inform them of their rights. The school, or the government rather, also requires in general that the school have trained the officials who will be working with students how to do a fair investigation, how to avoid re-traumatizing students, and generally treat them fairly and empathetically throughout this process.
And the school that you focused on, at least for your piece in Slate, was Peachtree Ridge High School. And that's because there is still an ongoing investigation in this involving the federal government. Explain to me which part of the story is not in dispute at this point. What happened, which is confirmed by both sides?
So all sides confirmed that there was some sort of incident involving two then sophomore students in February of 2015, in which the female student performed oral sex on the male student. She says that this was not consensual, that she was coerced into doing this, that it was an extremely traumatic experience. He says that it was consensual, though some of his statements have sort of seemed to contradict that in school hearings. The school confirms that this happened and that there was an investigation about it and that the students were placed in a joint disciplinary hearing in which the school sort of tried to adjudicate the case and then suspended both students for 10 days for what it said was consensual sexual activity. So all of those facts, that this incident occurred and that the school then did this sort of joint disciplinary process and suspended both students together, those facts are not in dispute. What is in dispute is whether this was a sexual assault, which the female student says that it was, and also whether the school's handling of the case was above the board or whether it was in fact really a violation of what should have happened.
And that's why it's become a legal complaint submitted to the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. And Fatima, there's no question that every school is supposed to have a Title IX coordinator, correct?
Each school must have a Title IX coordinator. But what we know is that even schools who say they have Title IX coordinators, many times the Title IX coordinator doesn't even know that they have that role. And no one in the school community knows
that
they have that role.
What is that role? What is that person supposed to do?
Well, that person is really supposed to be the point person for ensuring Title IX compliance. They should ensure that harassment and assault allegations are investigated appropriately. They should ensure that the school is taking appropriate action and that protective measures are in place. And that is going to require some training. And they should be the point person ensuring that they have training and really that other important people in the school have training as well.
My guests are Fatima Goss-Graves of the National Women's Law Center and also freelance journalist Nora Kaplan Bricker. Her article on this issue appears in Slate magazine. And it's clear, Nora, why one might need a Title IX coordinator, because you report that during the disciplinary hearing, an assistant principal said, quote, "I don't know that I'm trained to qualify what is sexual assault." Why did the school suspend both students? Why did it come down to a suspension?
So the school, like many high schools, had or has a rule on the books that says consensual sexual activity, you know, any sexual activity on campus is a violation of the school rules. And the school found in the course of its investigation, you know, because the school deemed the male student, quote unquote, more credible than the female student, and you know, we can go into why that was and why that's troubling to begin with, but because that was their finding, they decided that this was consensual and therefore it was in violation of the rules and therefore both students must be punished. That in and of itself is a violation of what the federal government and the Department of Education have been telling schools for years now, which is that if a student comes forward and says, "My civil rights have been violated," which is, you know, what a student is saying in essence when they say
sexual assault is a violation of civil rights, absolutely. Okay.
Of course. Then in that case, the school can't take retributive action against that student, you know, even if there is no finding that a right has been violated, even if the school can't sort of determine one way or another what happened here, they still can't take action against the student who complained without sort of compounding the problem or compounding the violation that's occurred. And so right there, the school already, you know, did something that the Department of Education has said it shouldn't happen.
So Fatima, one of the things that Nora points out in her reporting is that there has been a big focus on sexual assault on college-level campuses. The office, the Department of Education opened 324 cases during Obama's tenure. So far, 52 of those have been resolved. And yet, that is not the kind of numbers that you see in K through 12 schools. Why the big difference?
You know, this particular case is really extreme, but it is not an anomaly. What we know is that, according to the Department of Justice, about 18% of high school girls say that they've experienced some sort of unwanted sexual contact. But it hasn't received the same level of attention that we've seen in college or in the military. And so really, high schools and middle schools are behind the ball. They are still making really big mistakes. They're not doing the training that they should be doing. And sometimes they either ignore or have incompetent responses. And so the work at the high school level is even greater in terms of what needs to be done.
And one thing that you quote, Nora, is somebody from the Victims' Rights Law Center saying that the most common response from a school is that they can't do anything about it. Why is that problematic?
That's problematic because, and I'm glad you highlighted that, because even in cases where the school can't sort of figure out definitively what happened, as Fatima said earlier, they have this responsibility under Title IX to make sure that all these students can access their education fully regardless of sex. And so when they're saying we can't do anything, they're saying we can't really defend that right for a student who says that she or he has been sexually assaulted. So even in a case where the school says, we can't figure out what happened here, they should still say, what relief can we offer? How can we keep these students apart? How can we provide mental health support? How can we make sure that both of these students are still able to get the full education to which they're entitled?
And Fatima, one common complaint from schools is that they don't have the funding for a Title IX coordinator. Is that a credible argument?
Well, Title IX is going to be 45 years old next year. And so the idea that just now schools should be thinking about whether to have a Title IX coordinator is a little absurd. There are a lot of resources that are out there, including recent resources from the Department of Education that would be really, really useful for schools who are serious about addressing this problem. And one of the things that Nora raised that I think is really important is that schools have the ability to make it so that students want to stay in school. They have the ability to make it so that students feel comfortable. They have the ability to address further harassment that often comes after someone is assaulted. Those are things that only the school can really do.
So we only have about a minute left, Nora. What is the solution here? Are most of these cases going to have to be tried individually through the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights?
I certainly hope not. I think, you know, this is a really complex problem, but I think the solution starts with every school having a well-trained Title IX coordinator, someone who can look at everything that's going on in an investigation or a case at the school and say, well, I've read everything that the Department of Education has put out, and here's what we need to do, and here's what we certainly can't do. And somebody who says to the student and the student's family, you know, here's what's available to you, please work with the school. You know, we understand what we're doing in this case. Even just having that one person in every school, I think, would make an enormous difference. And that really did appear to be lacking in this case in Gwinnett County.
That is freelance journalist Nora Kaplan-Bricker. Fatima Goss-Graves of the National Women's Law Center joined us as well. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Just a note, the following conversation may include language that is challenging for some of our listeners, so listen with caution. A federal judge from Savannah, Georgia, made American history 25 years ago this month. Clarence Thomas was confirmed as an associate justice to the Supreme Court on October 15th, 1991. But it was the media circus that surrounded his confirmation hearings that made Thomas a household name. A young law professor named Anita Hill came forward to testify against Thomas before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The nation watched in disbelief on this very day in 1991 as Hill alleged that Thomas made unwanted sexual advances toward her, and those descriptions were graphic.
He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess.
Clarence Thomas denied any wrongdoing, and then he threw his own accusations into what has now become an iconic phrase.
As a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
The U.S. Senate very narrowly confirmed Thomas, 52-48, and he became the second African-American on the high court. Today, we will look back on his tenure, and I'm joined by Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Celeste.
And also with us is Stephen Gottlieb. He teaches at Albany Law School in New York. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tanya, this high-tech lynching that he was talking about, that very concept, is something that he's kind of stuck to throughout his career and has repeated in various permutations. I want to play this clip from a 2013 interview on C-SPAN. And they asked Clarence Thomas if he ever thought he'd see an African-American become president, and here's what he said.
I knew that it would have to be a black president who was approved by the elites. The media, because anybody they didn't agree with, they would take apart. And that will happen with virtually, you pick your person, any black person who says something that is not the prescribed things that they expect from a black person will be picked apart. You can pick anybody. Don't pick me. Pick anyone.
I'm going to pick him, though, because it almost sounds as though he's responding to people who say that he's too conservative. Is that fair?
I I think what he is trying to say is that unless you are your politics or your expression of your politics is aligned with the established order, the status quo, that you are not going to be deemed acceptable or appropriate, and that that determination, your qualifications are made based on that rather than, you know, the quality of your analysis or the work that you've done or, you know, your educational background, et cetera. And I think, you know, he has been consistent because his comments there describing why President Obama was an acceptable candidate despite the fact that he was African-American is in line with his own his comments about his own confirmation.
And Stephen, what do you make of this? I mean, especially the hearings, without us retrying the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, do you feel as though Clarence Thomas has been able to move away from that and have his legal career be judged separate from the confirmation hearings?
Oh, I think that's true. Despite the fact that he doesn't speak at oral argument, his opinions speak very forcefully for a point of view. And by the way, I think he's right that there is an extra millstone on the neck of African-American candidates. And they get...
Do you mean any candidates or candidates for the court?
I was being more general. Mm-hmm. I think he's quite right, and I've seen it work where people misinterpret what African Americans say and their positions, which may have something to do with why he does not speak. By the way, he does speak; it's just not public. He speaks to Breyer all the time.
Yeah, I don't think anybody thought he was mute.
They tell jokes to each other, and it's obvious from the audience in the court.
We're going to get into that, but let's go back a little further in his history and talk about his growing up in Georgia, because it's something that he has talked about as helping to form the justice that he is. Here he is speaking about his early days in Savannah.
I was the only black kid in my seminary in Savannah in 1965 to 67, and one of two in 1964 to 65. So you could see the world hadn't changed in Savannah. What I found in getting along with the white classmates is to look at them not as white kids or as different, but as kids. There's some less flawed, some who are flawed, some less flawed. I don't know. But in the end, they're all human beings.
So Clarence Thomas was born in Pinpoint, Georgia, in 1948, which was not an easy time to be a black kid in the South. How do you think that experience may have influenced him as a juror?
Well, as he expressed, he tried to see kids not for their color, but as just children that he was in classes with. And I think if you fast forward to a lot of his jurisprudence that expresses the idea of colorblindness as the constitutional ideal that we are going to apply the law without regard for color, it's consistent with the ways in which he navigated those spaces where he was the only black person, was to not see the color of his classmates. And perhaps, you know, in his experience, that made it easier for him to navigate those challenging spaces.
There's some other things that he did. He dropped his Georgia accent. He made sure that he was a picture perfect example of a smart, educated human being.
He attempted to assimilate.
Yeah.
And he also worked really hard not to fit the stereotype. But in doing that, you don't give yourself permission to be yourself. We don't have to be perfect as black people or black jurists to be equal. And that attitude of I must assimilate in order to be treated as equal, I think resonates throughout a lot of his opinions as they relate to topics around race.
We're going to get into that for sure. We would love to hear from those of you listening. How do you think history will remember Clarence Thomas? We asked on Twitter. Ted Barfield tweets, hopefully as a great and accomplished man, there is no basis for any other remembrance unless you're a hopeless demagogue. And Craig Flook tweets, what we'll remember most about Thomas is being, quote, replaced by an Obama. Tweet us now. That's hopeful thinking for you, at least, Craig. Tweet us now at OST or join our conversation on Facebook. My guests are law professors Tanya Washington of Georgia State University and Stephen Gottlieb of Albany Law School. I'm trying to say there's no, at this point, no plans for anybody to nominate President Obama or Michelle Obama to the Supreme Court. I assume that's a little bit of a joke. But I wanted to go back, Stephen, to your comments about Clarence Thomas not talking. And when we say he's not talking, he's not speaking up or asking questions pretty much hardly ever during his entire time on the Supreme Court. In 2013, he actually broke a 7-year silence. There was a discussion going on about the qualifications of an attorney. It sounds like Thomas was trying to poke fun at the expense of Yale Law School. So Thomas uttered 4 words. Well, he did not. Let's take a listen here to what he said.
But Ms. Lehman at that time was a very experienced attorney.
And another of his counsel, Mr. Singer, of the 3 that he had, he was a graduate of Harvard Law School, wasn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
Son of a gun.
Very Is that the minimum constitutional?
He did not.
He says, see, he did not provide good counsel. But it wasn't a question. People keep waiting for him to question people. Stephen, why doesn't he?
He hasn't told me, to be honest with you. one can speculate that there's been he has said from time to time that he doesn't see a lot of benefit in the process of oral argument, and therefore doesn't participate, although he's there, and he's there and he's active in other ways. So he gets books delivered to him. He sends things back. You can see that there's a degree of activity that he's present during the arguments. He just doesn't articulate what's going on in his mind and hand for the audience.
And that's one way in which he's sort of distinguished himself is by being silent. But another way, Tanya, is that he was not the African-American judge many African-Americans were waiting for. In other words, somebody that might bring a very different, more sympathetic perspective to the court. Here he is during a forum at the Pepperdine University School of Law. He was asked about whether or not the Supreme Court has a role or a duty in combating racism.
I have never understood the notion that we could continue to focus on race in order to get over race. I've never understood that we have to continue to identify us in a, you know, to be race conscious in order not to be race conscious.
What can we glean from his decisions on issues of race?
Well, I think he's summed it up. He is of the mindset that the way to get over racial discrimination is to end racial discrimination. In other words, not to see race, to adopt a colorblind perspective and a colorblind jurisprudential philosophy where the law is neutral and takes no account of racial inequities, racial disparities, racialized realities. And that comes through in his opinions in the voting rights context, in the context of affirmative action, employment discrimination. So his perspective is one that if we really want to become a colorblind society, which he perceives as the ideal, the thing we do is to ignore race. Others who critique that perspective say, how can we eliminate racial discrimination, which clearly still exists by, you know, hard evidence,
right?
How do we get rid of that without first acknowledging the history and the reality of racism?
Can I supplement Tanya's answer there? I certainly agree with what she was saying, but I think there's an additional thing that we need to understand, and that is, while on the one hand he talks about colorblind, and I would even describe what he's saying as what blacks don't get for themselves isn't worth having. But when you look at the at another set of cases where issues are raised on behalf of white parties, his jurisprudence is completely different. So when you look at, for example, there's a whole spate of cases involving the way the districts were drawn in a number of states.
Gerrymandering, yeah.
Various forms of gerrymandering and the application of the Voting Rights Act. And even in those situations where blacks were underrepresented, he was finding that the white group in that area wasn't sufficiently represented. So there's a dilemma there or a contradiction there. There are a whole lot of different legal questions that were used to address those situations, but ultimately what's going on is that there's a preference for white complaints in a fairly large group of cases.
Douglas Hooker tweets, Clarence will be remembered as a first and as an icon of don't judge the book. Don't judge the book by its cover. I think that's relatively fair. But it's not just racial decisions, I think, that Clarence Thomas has had a real impression on. Let's hear from him. This was an oral history interview. Former Georgia lawmaker and NAACP chair Jolene Bond was speaking with Thomas about what goes through his mind when he's writing his opinions.
These opinions have an enormously long shelf life. So it is critical that they not be based on shifting sands of fads and what's popular, but rather principles that are locked down and that will be here when the tides turn or the wind blows in a different direction.
So, and we also got a tweet from somebody called Rabbit, who says Clarence Thomas was in keeping with his time but neglected to shift positions when it failed. Assimilation cannot bring equity. Tanya, what will we remember? Still live and kicking and doing quite well, Clarence mm-hmm. Thomas, but what kind of legacy has he built so far?
I hope that we will remember him for his competency as a jurist, for his intellect, and not for the scandal that plagued his confirmation.
With Anita Hill.
Right, with Professor Hill. And I, you know, my objections to some of the positions he's taken are political, right? You know, I disagree with the positions that he's taken. But questions about his competency and his ability as a judge on the Supreme Court, who had a higher ABA rating than Rehnquist, who served as the chief judge for many years, to me is the wrong critique of his work. I think his opinions are, for the most part, consistent, at least as consistent as that of other justices on the court, some of whom, I disagree with the positions they take as well. So I hope that he will have, an earned reputation as a jurist who expressed a certain perspective on the law, original intent, and what he considers to be kind of apolitical decision making, although there is no such thing as neutrality, in my opinion. But I hope that will be his legacy and not the legacy that's centered around his confirmation.
And the reason we're talking about it is because 25 years ago today, Anita Hill was accusing him of sexual advances. Tanya Washington is a law professor at Georgia State University. Stephen Gottlieb is at Albany Law School. Clarence Thomas was confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court 25 years ago this month. Tanya and Stephen, thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Celeste. Take care, Stephen.
You too.
2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize. That honor has been awarded to dozens of people from or living in Georgia. And so we've asked past winners to spend some time with us, and it's a series we call Pulitzer Peaches. Cynthia Tucker is a well-known name to many Georgians. She spent 17 years as the editorial page editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and then won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 2007 after being nominated twice before that. She transitioned to a role as political columnist for the AJC and has also served as a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. Tucker currently writes a syndicated weekly column called As I See It and is based in Alabama, where she joins us from now. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning.
For those who are not journalists, Can you give us a quick primer in what a columnist is and how an editorial page, for example, differs from the rest of a newspaper?
Certainly. I'm glad you asked that question because there is common confusion about this. I write an opinion column. In the news pages, reporters are expected to stick to the facts, to keep their opinions out of it. My job is to have an opinion. It should be based on facts, but my job is to have an opinion. Often readers who disagree with me say, that's just your opinion, to which I always say, right, you caught me.
But does an opinion columnist have to be factually based? In other words, if there are factual errors in your column or Nick Kristof's in the New York Times, does that mean that they get called to task? Do you get called to task by your editors?
Absolutely. At the best news organizations, opinion columns absolutely should be based on facts. And I have an excellent editor at my syndicate. I am syndicated by an outfit called Universal UClick, and he tries to keep me on track. I try very hard to do my own fact-checking. That's what I taught my students to do when I was teaching journalism at the University of Georgia. Go back and check the facts on which you have based your opinion. I try to do something. Sometimes something slips by me, and my editors are very good at coming behind me and saying, no, that's incorrect. It's this instead. So, yes, at good news organizations, in an opinion column, you are called to task if you get your facts wrong. If I attributed some outrageous remark to Donald Trump that he did not say, yeah, I should get called to task for that.
And you have been writing about Donald Trump quite a bit. I found it interesting that the Pulitzer Prize Committee, in when you got the award, they wrote, quote, her courageous, clear-headed columns that evince a strong sense of morality and persuasive knowledge of the community. And it's that last part that really interested me, because that's not something that many columnists are noted for, a knowledge of the community. How do you achieve that?
Well, when I won the Pulitzer Prize, I was still the editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And I had been living and working in Atlanta for decades at that point. And I always believed, as editorial page editor, that my job at the AJC was to focus on state and local issues. I would remind my colleagues on the editorial page that we weren't like, say, the Washington Post or the New York Times in this sense. They covered a lot of national issues. And we knew that the president and members of Congress relied on those news agencies for reports on big national events. My editorial page absolutely paid attention to big national events. We weighed in repeatedly, for example, on the invasion of Iraq. But our first task, our major mission, was to concentrate on things happening in the state of Georgia, in the governor's office, at the state legislature, at Atlanta City Hall, at Atlanta School Board, and in the surrounding suburbs, because there were no other newspapers that were doing that.
How do you curate yourself? And by that, I mean, how do you know that something is worthy of a column as opposed to something that you're just irritated about?
That's an excellent question. I am not sure how well I do that. I have always given myself permission to write about things that I am interested in. Because those are the things that, if I'm passionate about something, the writing is better. On days that I sit down and I try to write about something that I'm not really interested in, the writing doesn't go very well. It's stilted. It doesn't have any passion. So I give myself permission to write about things that I'm interested in. But I read enough news reports and listen to enough news outlets and talk to enough people that I can tell when something I'm interested in is also something a lot of other people are interested in. Sometimes it isn't. So I have written, for example, about shutting down Guantanamo Bay, our detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. I'm not sure that many of our readers are interested in that, but I still give myself permission to write about it from time to time. I think it's important.
Let's then talk about your role as an editorial page editor. This has come up recently, and I wanted to ask you a question that I have had during this election cycle, which is, does a newspaper's endorsement or unendorsement, non-endorsement of a presidential candidate, do you think it matters anymore? Do you think people give that credence?
It does matter. But for the reasons that you might think. I don't think it matters because it necessarily changes people's minds. I don't think it changes people's minds any more than any other opinion piece. When a newspaper issues its endorsement of a candidate, it is merely giving its opinion about which candidate is better suited for the job. But it also, if the editorial is well written, the newspaper reveals the principles and the policies that it believes are important. There are newspapers around the country which have now gone against their own history an editorial philosophy to endorse the Democrat over the Republican. Some of those newspapers have never endorsed a Democrat for president before. When they outline the reasons why, they reveal to readers their own principles, what they believe is important. That may not change the mind of a single Trump supporter, but it lays out for the newspaper's readers the principles they think are important. And I think I happen to believe in this election season, if you are conservative and you have taken a stand against Donald Trump, that's going to be important. That's going to be important 5 years from now and 10 years from now when you talk about which side you are on. So I think editorial endorsements matter in that sense.
So my last question for you is, did the Pulitzer Prize change anything for you in terms of your work?
You know, it didn't change the way I wrote. It didn't change the things I wrote about. I've always been a bit eclectic in terms of subject matter. I just said that I've always given myself permission to write about things that interest me.
Yeah.
What the Pulitzer did was to give me more confidence, to affirm for me that what I was doing was important, that my colleagues in the broader journalism world considered my work really good.
Yeah.
And that gave me even more permission to pursue the things that I think are important. For example, some of my Pulitzer columns were about voting rights and Republican efforts to trim voting rights. I have continued to do that. and I am glad that my colleagues affirmed the worth of that work.
Cynthia Tucker, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, spent 17 years as the editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Cynthia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Macon native Mark Smith spent 9 years as a Marine. He completed 3 tours overseas, but it was his second tour in Iraq that cost him his left leg when he stepped on a mine in Ramadi. Despite that injury, Smith remained in the military for 5 more years. He even served another tour in Afghanistan. That's where he was, as he puts it, blown up again after his convoy hit an IED. Now Mark Smith is back home in Georgia with a new job in law enforcement. He is the first amputee to graduate from the state's trooper school. Producer Jessica Metzger recently rode along with Trooper Smith while on duty in Perry, Georgia, and she brings us this audio postcard.
594 Perry, 1038. 75 southbound. Growing up, I always knew I wanted to be law enforcement or military, one of the two. And as I got older, it kind of progressed more towards military first. And so, hence, I did the military first right out of high school. I did a total of 9 years, and I was up for reenlistment again. And a buddy of mine, who's a trooper, we graduated high school together, and he went into law enforcement, I went into the military. And he was telling me about how the State Patrol was hiring, and I figured at that point, you know, 3 tours already. I've been blown up a few times, so it's time to, you know, take a new course. And then, I got one.
All this shows me is whether or not your active is valid. I can't run it and see how many tickets you got in the past. If you go on,
let's see. I got injured October. When did I get injured? See, my birthday was October 8th, and I got October 13th because it was 5 days after my 21st birthday. We were on a dismounted foot patrol, and we had to cross the street. And in crossing the street was where they had put the, it was a landmine or something, but because it was kind of in water. So I was sloshing through the water and just ended up stepping on it. And I remember thinking to myself, because you see in the war movies, you know, the guys get hurt like that, and they always end up passing out because of the pain. And I was praying to God. I was like, please let me pass out because this really hurts. Sometimes they get upset that you give them a ticket. Other times, like that lady, she was like, oh, I'm sorry. And once I did get my leg, it was luckily because I'm a below-the-knee amputee, it wasn't nothing to it. I just put it on and started walking. And the biggest part of it was just conditioning my body to be able to wear my leg long enough. Because when you start out, it's pretty painful. You can't wear your leg and stand up on it and put pressure on your stump, but you know, only so many, you start out with so many minutes a day and then so many hours a day and then just kind of work your way up. This is radar right here. I have a front antenna right here, so I can check like that car right there coming up. He's doing about 50 miles an hour. I do have different legs. I have like a swimming leg. I have a running leg. I guess you'd call the leg I'm wearing now is my work leg, just because it's designed to where I'm able to wear my backup pistol on my ankle. And I actually even have a peg leg. I mean, why not? So it's Halloween. I'm pretty much always a pirate. 1049, 1008, one arrest. There's other occupations out there, but this is one of those that you definitely have to have the calling for it, because especially in law enforcement nowadays, with you know, how law enforcement is increasingly unpopular with people, and so you definitely have to have that calling to be able to deal with all the stuff that we encounter. Whereas like a 9-to-5 desk job, if you make a mistake, oh well, the reports don't get put in on time. Out here, if you make a mistake, it could, you know, literally be, you know, life or death. I'm not trying to, you know, church it up or anything, but that's just the truth of it.
Our thanks to the Georgia State Patrol for letting us ride along with Trooper Mark Smith. And that's our show for today.